Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, Xabi Alonso to Real Madrid looks like almost being a done deal, but how would the Spaniard fit in at the helm of the Spanish side? Can he restore them to the top of European football? Then we open up the burn book. While over on the paid side, we look at players who were misunderstood throughout their careers. We ask whether stats are ruining football and it's becoming too robotic. And then we discuss the kinds of people we hate for no reason whatsoever in anything but football. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we're back for another double episode of Unseen Incidents. Pete Dorman, how you doing, man?
Hello, hello, hello. I'm very good. I'm very good. How are things with you, Patrick?
Good, man. Good. I'm tired.
Yeah.
I'm doing lots of podcasts. I just think that when you come back as well from like the 4-day weekend, it's like 4 days looking after the kids, and also, you know, you can normally steal a little bit of time on Monday to get ahead with some of the stuff you've got for the rest of the week. And instead, I just feel like I've been trying, you know, when you've slipped to the back of the treadmill and you're trying to get towards the front of it so you don't fall off.
On Wednesday or Thursday of last week, I turned to Jess and I was like, it's going to be so nice having 4 days off work in a row for the long bank holiday. And then Tuesday morning came round like in the absolute blink of an eye, and it literally felt like the bank holiday weekend just didn't happen. And to be honest, quite a lot of things actually did happen in the past 2 weeks. You know, it was our first wedding anniversary.
I know.
More importantly, Rory McIlroy won the Masters, completed the career Grand Slam.
No one cares.
No, you don't care. Lots of people cared. I've actually heard...
No one who matters cares.
I've actually heard that moment was the most watched sporting thing on Sky Sports ever in the UK.
Yeah, but people watching Sky Sports have lost the will to live.
Sure. And then what else has happened in that time? Oh, Olivia Dodd met Bonnie. Bonnie was not a fan, so congratulations to Bonnie.
Yeah, well done. Good judge of character.
Yeah. I mean, like, immediately, as soon as I mean, like, milliseconds from me, my hands leaving Bonnie and Olivia Dodd's hands being the sole hands on Bonnie, screaming. So she only held her for like maybe 30 seconds before giving her to Jess. I've never been more proud of my daughter in the 9 short weeks that she's been alive.
Well, over a certain age, a childless woman.
we're 2 minutes 55 seconds in.
You're like, which? I've got to say, actually, while we're here, like, you posted a picture on your Instagram this week.
Yeah,
that I was like, if Ireland, like as an island, went to war tomorrow, this would be the best propaganda picture they
could
have.
This would be the Helen of Troy.
Yeah, it's like literally a picture of your wife, like in dramatic lighting.
Yeah,
breastfeeding your baby while drinking a pint of Guinness. And I was like, this is like the Rosie the River. Like, this would, like, I'm not Irish. And this makes me be like, right, come on, lads. Like, we're going to grab a fucking billy club and a shotgun, and we're going off to fight the Nazis.
We'll grab your shoes.
Obviously, the Nazi advert would be exactly the same. It's just that it would be like a pint of beer instead of a Stein.
Yeah.
It'd be like a Paulaner. Yeah, exactly. So it'd be exactly the same advert. But still, I was just like, fuck yeah. I feel patriotic about Ireland right now. Like, as a unified nation.
Yeah. Your wife also replied to that picture, and I have quite a few of those now because we seem to exclusively only go to pubs and wine delis as activities with Bonnie. And also your wife kind of didn't pressure me into, but like low key give me like the green light to go and buy a very, very expensive camera.
Yeah.
Give me the green light that she didn't have the right to give, but I was completely happy with accepting it. And now I have probably over 1,000 photos since then. Yeah, there's lots. But many of them are just of, like, there's none of me, it's all of Jess and the baby, but mostly in pubs. And yeah, I did particularly like the composition of that photo and everything it represented.
It's very beautiful. And yeah, I think, as you pointed out, the two most important things to you in a picture.
Yeah.
And Jess.
Okay.
We've already done a couple of sexisms, so I guess that we're like ready to get into the show properly. Basically, Real Madrid They stink, Pete. They stink.
Mm.
They lost home and away to Arsenal in, like, I mean, there was zero luck to it. It wasn't like they could convince themselves, like, oh, this was bad, you know, oh, we got a couple of bad calls, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, it was just a really bad performance, and they looked terrible. And so, obviously, now it feels like we're accelerating towards the end of the Ancelotti's second period at the club. And probably rightly so. Like, I love Carlo Ancelotti. He is the greatest manager in the history of European competition. At the same time, this Madrid team does need to evolve. And it's no lot because it's quite weirdly formed, you know, the squad is a bit lopsided. It probably does just need less of a vibes guy and more of a mechanic to kind of get it up and running. So Xabi Alonso is really the only seriously mooted name right now. I think everybody assumes that he's going to go there. He's done, let's be honest, everything that he could do for Leverkusen. So shall we talk a little bit about him as a candidate before we get into what kind of a fit he is for Madrid? Because I think while elements of it are obvious, he used to play for the club.
Mm-hmm.
He's Spanish. He's young. Like, he seems like a progressive coach. He's got the best out of some of the players there. I don't know how much sense it makes. I do have question marks about it. But let's talk about him first.
Yeah, I think, like you say, his time at Leverkusen could not have gone better. And I'm saying gone as if this is like already agreed, and it isn't, but it feels like it is in many senses. But when he arrived at Leverkusen in October 2022, they were 17th, relegation zone. They finished 6th that season. If you started the season when he joined, they finished 4th. The season after was like the incredible, magic, historic, unbelievable, never before seen season that nobody could believe, going unbeaten in the Bundesliga for the first time ever, any team, which is kind of crazy that Bayern have never gone,
I know, right,
invincible. And obviously, like, it's kind of ironic that Leverkusen had never won the Bundesliga, and that was like the monkey on their back. And not only did they do that, they also managed to achieve something that Bayern have never managed to achieve. Outside of that, or alongside that, they also went unbeaten for 51 games in Europe, setting also a record there. Also, like, a proper 51 game unbeaten streak, not like your shitty Arsenal Invincibles, 14 draws and 38 games. They won 42 of those 51 games and drew 9.
Yeah, but we did it in a proper league.
Sure, but I mean, I owe that always an asterisk. Always
let's
an
be
asterisk
honest,
to the Invincibles.
And let's be honest, the streak would have continued if not for one of the most flagrantly corrupt games in the history of football.
I think that game was completely fine. United were completely deserved winners. And you will never get me to admit otherwise.
It is up there with that Barcelona-Chelsea game. You know, the one where Drogba
shouted
to the camera afterwards, where he's like, it's a fucking disgrace. Like, and you're like, I hate Chelsea maybe more than any other club on earth, but it is one of the most corrupt refereeing performances I've ever seen.
But yeah, like, this tenure at Leverkusen has been so incredible, that, like, unbelievably incredible. And I said at the end of last season that I thought he should move then, because he was there was the Bayern job was available, the Liverpool job was available, and I was like, again, he's got links to both of those clubs, kind of similar to this summer with Madrid. He's got links to both those clubs. I think that his stock is at an all-time high now, because he's done the unthinkable. It can only go down from here. And that he needs to kind of cash in on his stock being as high as it is. I don't think I was necessarily wrong in that sense, but it wasn't right. So I don't think his stock's gone down, but I don't think his stock's any more valuable. But I do think it's more, people are more comfortable with calling it what it is, because he's had another season where he's proven again to be a top manager who's able to keep pace, or roughly keep pace, with teams like Bayern. Leverkusen are second this season. They're like marooned second. I don't know if they can statistically or mathematically finish first or third, but like, basically, if they can, it's like incredibly unlikely. We're talking like fractions of a percent.
So they've also, in the underlying numbers, got quite a bit worse, and
sure,
Bayern have got quite a bit better. So like, the gap between them in performance is quite big. But I do think that like works in his favor, right? As in, like, he's not coming, if he does come to Real Madrid, he's not coming on the back of doing the impossible twice, and he's also arriving at a Real Madrid that's in a much worse situation.
Yeah,
so it feels like expectation generally should be a little bit more reasonable than like, oh no, we're getting the greatest young manager available in the world.
It does serve a bit to like temper expectations, sure. But I think he did the unthinkable last season. To do to go back to back, which obviously Leverkusen have never, like they hadn't won one, never mind two in a row. So that was, nobody expected that to happen. Everybody expected Bayern to kind of right their ship and be at least, at very, very worst, competitive title race competitors, which they have been, and they'll win the title this year. So realistically, like the best Alonso could have done or been expected to do this season is finish second, which is what he will do. And when Leverkusen finish second, it'll be the first time since 1990-2000 that they finished in the top two in consecutive seasons. So for all intents and purposes, Alonso's come into a team as a young, unproven manager with them in the relegation zone, taking them to a he would have been European finish, sixth place, then won the league, and then finished as the best of the rest behind a Bayern team who have kind of quite rightly been the best team in the Bundesliga, as you would expect any given season. So not only is his stock just as high as it was last season, I agree that expectations are probably a little bit lower and a little bit more kind of manageable, but he's got an extra season under his belt where it kind of takes him a step further away from that was a fluke, that was a one-season wonder.
Yeah,
it gives a bigger sample size where he's had consistent performances across like a large sample size. So if you take, say, all of the games he's managed 90 Bundesliga games since he joined Leverkusen. In that time, Leverkusen have 186 points and a goal difference of plus 99. Bayern are fractionally better than that by 1 point and three goals. Everybody else are streets behind. We're talking like 15 plus points behind and about half the goal difference. So anybody taking a job at a German team that isn't Bayern Munich, realistically speaking, over a multi-season sample size, the best you can hope to be is the second best team in Germany, realistically, across a number of seasons, because it is just so impossible to keep Bayern at bay for multiple seasons.
And actually, they've been more like joint first.
Yeah, yeah. They across his entire tenure, they are fractionally behind. We're talking like a super tight. If you have a 2.75 seasons, I think so far it is. If you have a 2.75 season title race, we are neck and neck going into the last four games. Mm. So you really cannot ask for more. His tenure could not have gone better. I thought he should have moved last season and he didn't. He managed to keep the band together as well. You know, he didn't lose Wirtz. He didn't lose Frimpong. He didn't lose Boniface. Everybody stayed together, went, rolled the dice for another season. And for me, the gamble, because it is a gamble, like, they could have had a huge hangover season where they finished like 6th, 7th, 8th and all of a sudden the kind of shine is taken off Alonso a bit too much. That was a gamble and that could have happened. We've seen teams overperform or do the unexpected, the unbelievable in one season and then really struggle the next season, especially because they've got like greater things to play with. You know, like they're playing Champions League football. They've got more things, more expectations, more eyes. That can have a really adverse effect on teams. So he did gamble in that sense. He also could have lost one of his big players in the summer. Mm-hmm. And again, that'll have a really, really big effect on the team performance across the season. But none of that happened. They've played well. They've kind of done as well as you could have expected a team to do, finishing a clear second behind Bayern. And yeah, so his stock is as high as it was last season, but he's got more kind of value in the sense that there's more weight behind what it means. And I think people are more comfortable in calling him a good manager versus a manager who got lucky one season. So I think this is the time to move. I think this is a time that you think the Liverpool job's obviously gone. The Bayern job might become available now, so at some time soon. You know, I don't really rate company as a manager, so that could become available at some point.
Sure.
Man United might be available next season.
Oh, great.
Depending, this is the thing. You look at the amount of attractive managerial jobs coming up, and you think Real Madrid, there's a big connection. Yes, there's obviously the emotional connection. Former player, Spanish, like you said before. This feels like the right time. It feels like a right project. Mm-hmm. It feels like the right time to move. It feels like the time a number of his big players might move on as well. We spoke about Wirtz last episode. Frimpong, I could see moving. There are a lot of parts that could mean that Leverkusen next season, whether Alonso stays or goes, are a very, very different entity. And it feels just like the right time for Alonso to go. And I think he should go. And I think he's kind of earned this swing at Real Madrid. But I do think that it does present a very, very interesting shift in one, how Alonso approaches, sets up his team, and two, how Real Madrid set up and how they'll kind of operate under a manager like Alonso. Because I see a lot of positives, I see a lot of negatives. More than most, I see a lot of like areas that need decisions made as to where like compromises are made. Because this Madrid team, in my opinion, does not fit like for like in the way Alonso has been playing with Leverkusen.
So this is, yeah. I agree with that. Like, so this is the thing. I listened to some podcasts, I read some articles, I watched some YouTube videos kind of in preparation for this. And, you know, like, what do people think of Alonso to Real Madrid? And I was kind of surprised, maybe I shouldn't be, but I was kind of surprised that everything I saw was basically like, well, he's going to try and do the same thing. You know, he's going to play his Leverkusen system at Real Madrid. So they were all like, well, we assume he's going to play a back three. They've actually played nearly like just over a quarter of their games this season with a back four. But everyone's assuming they'll use a back three. And maybe they will do that. But the idea that they're going to play exactly the same way just seems really, really strange to me. Like, because I'll come onto this later, but it seems to me that like if you're talking about a manager going to another club, you want to try and differentiate the stuff that they do ideologically and the stuff that they do pragmatically. Mm-hmm. So what is the stuff they do because they believe that this is how football should be played? And what is the stuff that they do because these are the players they've got, or this is the league they're in, or whatever, you know, this is like the meta that they're dealing with.
Circumstantial.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if they do decide to play this way, though, again, I saw loads of things that were like, well, let's assume they're going to try and play the Leverkusen way. And then we're like, well, it can work in this, and this way. I don't think it can work. I think if he tries to play the way he's playing at Leverkusen at Real Madrid, I think it'll be bad. Mm. For a start, Real Madrid have got a problem fitting in all their midfielders and all their attackers. And if you bring in an extra centre-back, you're sacrificing one midfielder or one forward so you can play an extra defender, sure, which is a bit of a problem, for one. It also presents like a bunch of other issues. Like, one, they'd need to bring in at least one, but maybe two centre-backs. Because right now they've got Alaba, Rudiger, they've got the permanently injured Militao, and they've got Asensio who appeared out of nowhere. And that's it. After
True
that,
men,
they've
been playing centre-back for half the season.
Exactly. And Alaba's been out half the season. And I think Alaba used on the left side of a back three is great to me. And Rudiger's career at the top level could be prolonged by moving him to a central centre-back. But it's asking a lot of Asensio. And that's also all your fit centre-backs playing at once.
And two of them are over 30, one of them's 28.
Exactly.
Only one of them is under 25.
So you want to go and buy at least two defenders in that situation. So that's problem one. Problem two, they'd need a starting left wing-back. Felon Mendy is not that great and is not a left wing-back. Fran Garcia is 25 and is not that good and is not a wing-back. I think that this is an incredibly hard position to recruit for right now worldwide. Like, name the top young left backs who are not playing for a super club.
Patrick Dorgue.
It's like you got me there. But like, you know, but like Liverpool are looking at Kerkez this summer.
Yeah.
After basically 1 year of good performance at the Premier League level, that's the kind of thing that we'd be looking at if you talk about Real Madrid trying to do it. If they still had Theo Hernandez, that'd be one thing. But maybe there's somebody, you know, like when PSG bought Nuno Mendes, there's someone like that that Real Madrid would have their eye on. But that's quite un-Real Madrid, like, in their current way of recruiting. So that, I think, is a really hard spot to recruit for. Then you've got another thing. Obviously, you've got that existing problem. Too many attackers at the club. It makes that even worse by giving them fewer spots. And I don't think it solves a bunch of the issues you have anyway. So, like, this right-wing problem they've had this season. There's always a right-wing problem with Real Madrid. But, you know, Mbappe and Vinicius want to play in the same space. There's no real width on the right. And how are they solving this? They're bringing in Trent. Now, I like Trent a lot. And I think that Trent gives them a different kind of weapon. And he covers for the cross issue in lots of ways. And I think a good manager can get a lot out of him. But he is not going to, even if you play him as a right wing back, he's not a runner. He's not going to dominate that flank. Like, he can put in crosses and he can combine with someone out there, but does he have anyone to combine with out there? And what he's not going to do is pop up in the box and score a goal, really. Like, maybe he will against, like, bumfuck teams in Spain, but he's not going to do it in the Champions League against the best sides because that's just not his game. He's simply not that kind of athlete. So you could swap the way they do it at Leverkusen, which is it's kind of Grimaldo is more on the ball, more of a creator, steps into midfield, and Frimpong is the off-ball runner. So instead of having the off-ball runner on the right, you have it on the left. But then you still need that runner and that goal threat on the left. So again, do you go and get an old Theo Hernandez? Because he'd be really good at it. If Calafiori... Actually, if Arsenal had signed Calafiori And if he weren't injured all the time, he'd be quite interesting for that role because he looks a lot better in attack than defense. But otherwise, are they, you know, there were people saying, oh, well, maybe Rodrigo can play left wing back. And I was like, Real Madrid do not do shit like that. They just don't. Yeah. They don't do that. They're like, no, we have, they were hoping they'd get Alphonso Davies there. If they'd signed Alphonso Davies on a free, which is what they were hoping to happen, all of this would make sense. But because they didn't, it doesn't. And even if you had a top attacking left wing back there, you still don't have any balance. Because then you've got your attacking left wing back, Vinicius and Mbappe, all on the left-hand side. Who have you got on the right-hand side? Trent Alexander-Arnold. And maybe you're using like Bellingham as one of the guys behind the striker. Like maybe you're using Rodrigo, but even still, you don't have any width on that right-hand side.
I mean, that's assuming that that Mbappe and Vinicius will continue to relentlessly drift left, which, you know, they've shown no signs of not doing that, but that is like solving that, stopping that is like one of the main problems.
I agree, but that's exactly my point. Like, switching to this setup would not solve that problem, and in fact, would make it worse in some ways. So, yeah, I'm not saying that, like, that's not a problem now and it would become a problem, but when people are trying to say, oh, well, you can port over the Leverkusen system and this is how you would try and make it look at Real Madrid, I'm like, after I've looked at it for a couple of minutes, I think none of this really makes sense with me. You have all the same personnel issues you have now. You have to spend a ton of money just to make it work. Not even to make it good, but just to make it work. And I still feel that the right flank ends up being something like Trent Bellingham, but those are two excellent players, but that does not scare me at all as a side facing you. Like it's just not very, very exciting. So I think that I know that you've given it a go to see like if you can try and make this work. But to me, the whole thing has to be, we're changing everything. And there are other things I want to get into as well about their style of play. But I think it's worth looking at like your kind of ideas first.
I mean, I agree with basically everything you say in that these are the major red flags that I see about the composition of this Real Madrid squad and how it would actually translate to a like-for-like Alonso Leverkusen system. And centre-backs, like you say, we criticise them for being thin when they played a back four with two centre-backs. Adding an extra one on the pitch is, you know, just on like arguably an impossible task to manage because they literally couldn't manage to put two on the pitch based on the reliance of too many. So that straight away, I think wing-backs, basically I agree with your reservations, but I think they could potentially work in a really convoluted way. So I think you could work with Camavinga and Trent, but the reliance would be basically either you go very, very asymmetrical. So Trent is just the attacker and Camavinga sits. And you essentially kind of shift your back four in possession. Or they one or two of them both invert into midfield as a double pivot. And then you push your Valverde, Tchouaméni, Bellingham, whoever's in that double pivot forward. And go to that 3-box-3 that we saw a lot with like Man City. With Stone stepping through into that 3-box-3. Trent stepped into that 3-box-3 with late era Klopp. There are ways to kind of work in possession that don't rely, or that basically accommodate for the lack of physicality in terms of up and down the line that the likes of Camavinga, who's not a natural left wing back, not a natural left back, and Trent, who won't give you that physicality as a runner. You can accommodate for that, but still get the assuredness in midfield. You can still benefit from Trent's like incredible passing. And then forward ahead of that, you would still have a kind of more stable front line that wouldn't be have a load of players kind of trying to all, like you wouldn't have a left wing back in the left wing space standing beside Vinicius in the left wing space with Mbappe leading into the left wing space. You know, you would kind of alleviate that. So that would work one way if you play them as DM, play them as right wing backs and left wing backs, Camavinga and Trent, that is. DMs I have kind of slightly less issue with. I think they have a decent stable there with, you know, Valverde, with Tchouaméni, Camavinga, obviously. You can play Ceballos, you can play Bellingham further back as maybe the more advanced of the double pivot. They've got quite a lot to work with there. And I think a lot, like, Ceballos, a good passer. Valverde, decent passer. Bellingham's fairly creative. Like, there's decent enough passing from deep that you could get away with that. Obviously, like, the role that Granit Xhaka plays at Leverkusen is metronomic. Huge numbers of passes over the last two seasons. He has been
crazy.
By far, far and away, and I mean far and away, completing the most passes, attempting the most passes in the Bundesliga. He is like the key to that system in that he just keeps everything ticking over. I think he could probably find somebody in-house to do that reasonably well. I'm not that concerned about it. But then you step one line forward and you would have like a high two plus a centre forward which I guess naturally would be Vinicius, Bellingham, and then Mbappe as a centre forward.
Maybe.
It makes the most sense on paper as to what it is, as to what they have available, but it doesn't really make much sense in practice based on the fact that Mbappe's never wanted to naturally play in the middle. He always just left. He has always said he wants to kind of have the freedom to come left and come in. He doesn't want to stay central. Vinicius obviously is a left winger, is most dangerous when he's given the space out there in that wing. And kind of Bellingham would be fine in that role and has been fine in that role. But it feels like a lot of square peg round holes. And I guess like another way that you could do it would be that if you do that 3-box-3, I guess, so if Trent and Camavinga invert in, you push two up, you could have a more traditional front three. So you could play like Rodrigo, Mbappe, Vinicius, because you know that in possession you're essentially going to a 4-2-2-3, basically. Basically kind of like a 4-4-2 diamond almost, but slightly flatter. And that could work, but basically any way I cut this, any way I tried to like shoehorn a way in that this makes sense in possession on pitch, it felt kind of like a Rube Goldberg machine.
Exactly. Like, this is the thing. As you're talking, I'm literally like, maybe you start Valverde in the two behind the striker, and then Bellingham's in the eight with Camavinga, and then Valverde goes wide right, and Bellingham goes forward, and Trent steps into midfield. And I'm literally doing this, and I'm just like, this is stupid.
It's literally like a Rube Goldberg machine, where a series of convoluted, complicated, overly complicated movements have to happen to make it functional, and the end product that you end up with is a completely different system to the Leverkusen three at the back that you started with.
Yeah.
So the argument then what's the point?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You're like, what we need to do is like fix all this stuff to get, you know, it's like this idea of just like, well, I don't even know how to describe it. It's kind of like saying, well, I want to drive a BMW, but I don't want to sell my Honda. So I'm going to change the BMW doors for the Honda, like the Honda doors for BMW doors. And then I've got to change the frames for this. You know, you go through like 100 things. And after a while, you're like, I've ended up with this fucking Frankenstein's monster that makes absolutely no sense as one thing or the other. And it would have been better if I'd just like accepted, given up, and not tried to do two stupid things at once.
So it's like, they have all these amazing players. Or like they have a number of amazing players, and they all have many of them have quite set skill sets and set roles, and the collection of them just don't really fit into this. Because I also think it's quite naive just to assume that a manager who's proven to be as smart as Alonso, and Alonso was an incredibly smart player as well, a manager that's as smart as he is and as tactically sound as he is going to come in and just with the assumption that his system is going to work. Or that he's not going to know that he's going to need to make concessions, or he's going to need to... He has the ability to look at this squad and find a middle ground where he implements a system that he's comfortable playing and he thinks represents the type of football he wishes to play, but maximises the skill set of the collective that he has to work with. The idea that he's just going to copy and paste his system from Leverkusen to Real Madrid with the squad that he'll be inheriting is just quite a misguided and quite short-sighted view, because that's just not... If that happens, obviously anything can happen. If that happens, I will be astounded, because it functionally just doesn't work. And the way to make it work, you need to go through this convoluted, like, rotational system that ends up being a different system in the end.
Sure.
In possession. Okay. And then you can revert to it at... Like, if you're out of possession, if you want to press that way, sure. But realistically, fundamentally, it just doesn't work. It just doesn't fit. And trying to make it fit just would be detrimental to what you were trying to achieve.
So I agree with all that. And I think that this is the thing, you know, like, here we're talking about like players for roles and formation and stuff. But there are also kind of deeper parts of the play that do concern me a bit. So like, Leverkusen's football is a lot more boring than people think it is.
Hmm.
Like, I think because they see clips of like Florian Wirtz, or they think about Victor Boniface like running from the left wing or whatever, or they look at just like simply the footage of these goals they score in the last minutes of games. Like, that kind of excites people. Mm-hmm. But they actually just are not that interesting to watch. They really aren't. Like, they have a lot of possession. They have the second most goals in Germany this season, but they're fourth for expected goals, behind Frankfurt and Dortmund, and only just ahead of Stuttgart. So they're in the kind of pack of third to fifth for expected goals. They're also not like an aggressive pressing side. They can do it. And yeah. I do think that Alonso will probably improve on this as well. Alonso's a really young manager. And it does take time to get up to speed. You know, like, we're going to see this with Kompany. We've certainly seen it with Arteta. Like, with young managers, it takes a while for them to kind of get different skills under their belts. But right now, their pass per defensive action, they're at 12.8, which is quite high. And by high, I mean bad. So that would be fifth bottom in Spain. It'd be fifth bottom in England. Because the Bundesliga just doesn't press the way it used to. So that's one part of it. And actually, if you look at tackles in the final third, they're 39th of the 96 teams in Europe's top five leagues. When they press high as well, they often go man-to-man. I wish you the best of luck if you try and do that with Vinicius and Mbappe.
But this is a concern as well, yeah.
But now we're talking about much deeper issues. Like, we're not just talking about, like, oh, who's going to play on the right wing if he plays the same formation. We're talking about, can he coach a completely different style of press? How does he deal with defending? Because actually what's made them great is kind of their defense, right? Like, their defense this season is still fantastic. Like, how do you keep the defense really solid when maybe you're not playing a back three, so you don't have that extra man in defense, and you don't have, like, a really aggressive press because Vinicius and Mbappe aren't going to do it? Like, how do you deal with both of those problems at the same time? I don't know, man. Like, that sounds like quite a difficult job to me. So there are those issues that I have. But I am quite optimistic as well, for a lot of the same reasons as you. So I think, you know, firstly, you're right. He's not a stupid man. Like, he is going to figure some things out. And while knowing the league, I think, is overrated, Xabi Alonso has played for Real Madrid. And he's not under any illusion that he could turn up at Real Madrid and play boring, defensive, conservative football.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll try and do that his first season to just, like, solidify things. But he will at least say to Florentino Perez, look, like, this is what it's going to look like season one. And, like, basically, we've got to get this team rolling again defensively, because the attackers are good enough to beat anybody, but the defense is fucking ramshackle. So, like, that's it. Plus, there are just, like, you know, parts of his tactics which I think will stick and do make a lot of sense. So, you know, quite often if you watch Leverkusen, you will see pretty much the entire team shifting over to one side of the pitch into one really compressed area. And Madrid this season, you've so often seen attackers get completely isolated. Against Arsenal, there were loads of times where Mbappe would get the ball between the lines, or Bellingham would, or Vinicius would. And you'd look around and you're like, who's he meant to pass to? And there was literally nobody there. Like, nobody who he could pass to. He was surrounded by Arsenal players. Alonso will be much better at finding those connections, I think. Leverkusen are good at finding those passing options, even though they are doing it in a worse league where there is more space.
Yeah, I think they've played, like, by far and away the most short passes of any team.
Yeah.
It was everything they did was... They went quite direct and quite quick when they went in transition, but they were overwhelmingly short.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that, like, just moving it around like that with all the passes that they have will be good enough. Like, the fact that Real Madrid were thinking, oh, we need a Toni Kroos replacement because Toni Kroos left and now we're shit, so therefore we need to replace Toni Kroos. Like, I just think Alonso will not look at it that way.
Yeah.
He'll be like, we've got loads of really good passes. The problem isn't that, like, do Arsenal have loads and loads of passers who are better than Real Madrid's passers? Is that why Arsenal beat Real Madrid in the Champions League? Of course it isn't. That's ridiculous. That's just not a plausible take on things. So Alonso will get more out of the guys that they have. But yeah, I think there's this idea that, I think it's a real misunderstanding. And, like, I guess that we were all trying to make inferences with, like, imperfect information, but it's clearly backwards to say, well, Xabi Alonso, like, you watch Leverkusen and you say, well, Xabi Alonso likes a right wing back who makes off ball runs into the box, and that's why Frimpong's been really good for him. That's clearly backwards. The way around that it is Alonso sees what Frimpong is good at and has made a role to fit him.
Yeah, yeah.
And similarly, I think he'll do that at Real Madrid. You know, he'll figure out how they get the best out of Trent without making the right side an issue. Like, how they fix the lack of width in the front line. Do they need to sign someone new? Do they use Rodrigo more? Can he convince Mbappe or Vinny to play on the right? Does he just play them in a front two where they can both kind of be in the middle and you get width in some other different way?
Like, does he play Arda Güler? He doesn't want to. Like,
that doesn't seem likely. And also Arda Güler, like, I don't know, like, I like the idea, but Arda Güler.
Arda Güler, right wing back.
Jesus. But, you know, but from the but when we're talking about Arda Güler, the good thing about him is they can just sell him.
Like, I think that's probably the most likely thing to happen.
They can sell Güler. They could sell Rodrigo. They could sell one of Tchouaméni and Camavinga if they wanted. They could sell one of those guys. And there's actually like a ton of money.
That's a huge window, though. That's huge.
Yeah, but if they sold all those guys and brought in like three guys, I don't think that's a huge window.
No, that's a huge amount of moving part. I don't mean huge as in like the overhead. I mean like all of that happening in a single transfer window.
Yeah, I don't think that's that much. I think that's quite substantial. Because Güler's barely played, so it doesn't matter if he goes.
Güler will go, but I think shipping out, like, if you ship out too many, then you know you need to buy at least two centre-backs because you lose his option to play in that centre-back if you play for three.
But I think they need to do that either way. Like, yeah, I agree. Like, and I wouldn't want to sell Camavinga either, but I do think that if Real Madrid don't have a list of players who they might not want to sell but would be willing to sell to like get some money, then they're not doing a good job. Like, they absolutely do need to be like compiling that list. And I think as much as they might not want to sell Rodrigo is going to be on that list. If somebody comes in this summer with like 80 mil for Rodrigo,
yeah,
Real Madrid should say yes to that, or at least think seriously about it. So I don't know, maybe they end up thinking, oh, we're going to do like a 4-4-2 diamond or something, which I think actually could make quite a lot of sense.
Mm.
You know, but all the solutions I come up with are basically a slightly more functional version of the Madrid we have now, which is to say, not great, but it at least gets things moving in the right direction. And as you're saying, it means that you don't have to do left-back, centre-back, centre-back, right-back, right-winger, like all these signings in one summer and sell a bunch of other guys. Like, there are lots of benefits of doing it that way. But I think it definitely can work. But if it works, it's going to work because Alonso's going to turn up and do something totally different. If Alonso turns up and, like, we're seeing just, like, the Leverkusen model kind of transferred to Real Madrid, I have questions. I do not think that that would be a good idea. So, yeah, I think it's an interesting one. And I think the myth of Alonso, I think people are just absolutely convinced that he's going to play like this exciting, free-flowing football in the same way that, like, for years, Arteta was, like, described as this, like, Pep disciple. And then suddenly everyone was like, no, his football's really boring. And they went really far back the other way.
Mm.
Because they felt kind of let down by this expectation of what he was. Like, Arteta played under Moyes, like, as well as coaching under Pep and playing under Wenger. Xabi Alonso played under Benitez, as well as playing under Pep. Like, it's not surprising that these guys have a slightly broader view of... they have a slightly larger palette of tactical ideas that they can draw from. So, I don't know. I'm interested to see how it goes, but... I'm kind of surprised we didn't hear Arteta rumours after that game. Maybe those have happened, I just paid attention.
Do you think he would move, though?
No, I don't think he would move at this stage?
Like,
no, I don't think he would, but like normally, if Real Madrid lose to somebody and that person and that team has a player or a manager who could feasibly move to Real Madrid, then Real Madrid press starts saying, maybe we'll just take Arteta off you. You know, the same way they did this with Zubimendi. So in the run-up to the Arsenal game, suddenly there were loads of rumours that Real Madrid were going to like go and get Zubimendi. And then immediately after the Arsenal game, it was Real Madrid are going to go and take Zubimendi. And I was like, this is literally like Real Madrid trying to restore their egos after taking
their toys.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't want this toy, but I don't want you to play with it.
Yeah, they do this shit all the time, man. Okay, shall we move on to the Burn Book then? Okay, Burn Book time. Should we start with Out or In? Should we start with You or Me?
I'm going to start, if you don't mind, and I'm going to start with what I'm putting in the Burn Book.
Okay.
So what I'm putting in the Burn Book, obviously, new father. Bonnie is 9 weeks old this week. Yeah, almost 10 weeks old when this goes out. We're now around a lot of people with similarly aged children. I was at a two-year-old's birthday party on Saturday. It was quite fun. You know, this is my life now. But what has come into my life more than I would like is the prevalence of newborn photo shoots. And they make me oddly uncomfortable.
It's not odd. It's sensible. They're weird.
They're unsettling. I like nothing about them. There are literally zero redeeming features about newborn photo shoots. They are just objectively strange. I've never understood them, but they're like so common, and I see so many new parents talking about them or posting pictures from having their newborns in this photo shoot, in these photo shoots. And I think, you know what, like, everybody, fair play, do what you want, but they look weird. Like, it's a weird occurrence. For one, babies that young generally don't look quite good. They don't look very good. They're still kind of reacting to the trauma of being born.
Yeah.
Especially the ones that have come out vaginally, especially if they've had forceps or ventouse.
Mm.
Like, those heads are a bit fucked up for a while.
Yeah.
And generally speaking, Bonnie is one of the, like, outliers to this, because she's a pristine little baby. And that's not just like bias, that's because she was the wrong way up and was C-section, so her face is just like not being touched.
Chopped
so she kind of looks like she looks like a smaller version of an older fully formed baby.
Sure.
When they get like properly cute, whereas a lot of these babies who've just been born, like, they look like, let's be honest, they look a bit fucked up for a while. They look like little aliens. So there's a problem there, that any photo you take will look a little bit weird. So then why would you go out of your way to like strip them down and like place them in a fucking hollowed out pumpkin?
Oh my God. That's all that stuff. Yeah, it's all this thing where it's like, we just found this child like inside an acorn.
None of it makes sense.
I was there when they were born. It was like a horrifying trauma that everyone went through.
And then they do this like the weird like tummy time, prop their hands up with their on their elbows, and then put their chin in the like bottom of their hands, which are kind of like open, and you have this kind of weird smile, and their eyes are always closed because they're newborns, like they're sleeping most of the time. Every photo I've ever seen has just looked so strange. I think if we took every newborn photo shoot ever, or in the last 10 years, put them in a time capsule and left it for like future civilizations to look at in 2000 years, they would be like, what the fuck was going on with the species at this time? Because this is like the weirdest shit ever. And I just don't see why it's necessary, because clearly the end goal is to get cute photos of your child.
Yeah.
But even when your child's a little bit fucked up looking at the start, they're still pretty cute because they're a tiny little like human. They're cute in their own right. In normal settings, you could just take photos. Like, the photos you would send somebody on WhatsApp will be more cute than the photo and any photo you can get in this weird setting where you've like forced this scenario and this, like, you've used fucking props and you've put like hats on them.
And you've put them under studio lights.
Or you've tied the... There's one where they like almost they contort them into this like tiny little like shriveled ball. And it's just, all of it's just very, very strange. None of them look good, in my opinion. And any photo you send of me, candidly, just taking over your baby, sitting in their bouncer, in their bassinet, on the floor, on their back, whatever. Any photo you just snap from your iPhone, from a better camera, whatever, that will be unequivocally better than any photo you can ever get from these staged newborn photo shoots.
Agreed.
And babies, and the older they get, the better this gets. The fatter they get, the better this gets. One of their like superpowers is that they are just very, very cute. You don't need to force cute photos in convoluted settings. Just take photos of them. You'll find cute ones.
People who get professional photo shoots done, I find weird generally. Like, people who do it with older children, I find it weird. They always look terrible. The children always look like they're dead. Like, you know, they're like, RIP to our child. Like, he's with the angels now. Like, kind of soft focus. And also people, you know, like, people do it for engagement pictures and all this stuff. Like, it's just like weird shit. Yeah. I don't know. I don't care for it.
Like, the engagement one, I don't support the engagement one, but if you're using the engagement one as a... Sometimes wedding photographers do like pre-shoots.
Sure.
I suppose that's too far in advance, actually, because you'll be engaged for a while. Some wedding photographers do pre-shoots before the wedding day, so you're more comfortable when they ask you to do all of the wedding photos. But yeah, like, I think that as a thing to take pictures of, as an object, babies are just inherently cute. You don't need to force it.
And agreed.
By forcing it, you're actually you're absolutely diminishing their level of cute, because you're replacing their cuteness with weirdness or oddity because the scenario feels strange.
It's got a very 90s and also like backwater American flavor, which actually is kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, like a kind of Tiger King vibe to it, where it's like, here's my baby on like a fur rug.
Yeah.
And I don't think that baby enjoyed that.
No.
And like, you could just send me a picture of you holding the baby.
Yeah.
And I would consider that to be normal.
Yeah.
Instead of this like creepy nonsense. All right.
It's so strange. But yeah. All right. No time for it. Seeing it a lot.
It's a good one.
Recently, not for me.
I mean, you are going to have that for years to come. Okay. My one, what I'm putting in the burn book, one weird trick, right? You see this all over the internet. You used to see at the bottom of every page, like fake adverts, like generated adverts that were like, this housewife like whitened her teeth with one weird trick. Dentists hate her, like that kind of shit.
Oh, but the clickbait article kind of things.
But I do think that this kind of thinking has infiltrated basically every aspect of our lives, rather than just like accepting that sometimes you need to make an effort to like make lasting change. So apple cider vinegar, just drink apple cider vinegar. That'll solve things. Blue light glasses, they'll fix things. What else? Purple toothpaste, fasted cardio. Like, and a lot of people have this with exercise actually, where it's like, if I do my cardio before I've eaten anything on a given day, if I do my back before I do my arms, you know, then like there's this belief that like these tiny changes are gonna like absolutely change anything. This idea that like, oh, if I take melatonin, then all my shitty sleep habits are gonna be undone because like the melatonin will just ensure I have perfect restful sleep. If I don't take care of my diet and I don't work hard at the gym, but I have enough creatine, then I will magically get ripped. Like, it's just like childish. I just find it a very childish way to think about things. And like, it is everywhere. So if you want to get in shape, then like eat more calories if you want to put on muscle and more protein and work out really hard, or eat fewer calories than you burn if you want to lose fat. Like that's very simple. If you want to sleep better, then make sure that you go to sleep at the same time every night. Mm. Like, don't sit and play around on your phone until it's time to go to bed. Like, maybe wear an eye mask, you know, whatever it takes, like keep your room dark, all this kind of stuff, like practice good sleep hygiene. I just think that all this kind of stuff is just lazy bullshit. And I do find it quite often with clients even, where there's this idea of like, what tip can you give me that will like fix my sleep? What thing can you do? Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, I can't motivate myself to do stuff. Can you tell me how to do it? And you're like, there is not a magical motivation secret that I can give you that will immediately make you like take hold of your life. That's not how things work. Like, you're going to have to try harder than that. So I just think that this has taken the place of consistent lifestyle change for a lot of people. And I don't know. I don't think that it's been good for our culture. What are you taking out of the burn book?
What I'm taking out of the burn book, I think for the second week running, influenced by you. So I wanted to take Rory McIlroy out, but I knew you'd hate that, and I knew you wouldn't. Not only would you not like it, you would completely like disconnect from it and not engage, and just let me say my piece, and then you'd be like, "Okay, what I'm doing." So it wouldn't be as fun a discourse as it usually is. So I honourable mention to Rory McIlroy, but what I'm taking out is one of your specialties. What I'm taking out is skincare.
Yeah, boy.
So this is something that I've gotten into. I say gotten into in the most liberal sense possible, because for me, this is like by far and away the most I've ever been involved in it, but it is still very much toe dipped in the water. But like, luckily over, you know, my life, I've not had bad skin ever really. Like, I've had kind of just completely manageable skin. I've been quite lucky in that sense. In one sense I've been lucky, but in the other sense it's been a reason as to why I've not ever had a skincare routine, because like, I've only really ever had one or two blemishes, and the occasional, like, once a year I'll get like a big blind spot that'll stick about for 2 weeks. Like, that's kind of what happens really in across my life. So I've never been in a position where I'm like, oh, my skin really needs like loads of TLC and that. So
sure.
I've never gotten into a skincare routine. I've, you know, sparingly used face wash, occasionally used moisturizer. You bought me some stuff for my birthday a couple of years ago. I think I still have some left of the moisturizer. I use the night cream a lot. That was great. But I would find myself buying things or being bought things, using them, being like, that was good, I liked that, I enjoyed using that. And when it ran out, I would just be like, well, okay, it's run out. And I wouldn't replace it. No lasting effect or no lasting routine would ever come from it. Largely due to the fact that I didn't really know where to go. I would just kind of raw dog what I had when I remembered to do it or when I cared to do it, but nothing everlasting came of it. So it was very, very stop start. My skin just kind of stayed at a default setting for the whole time because it wasn't really being affected by anything substantial. So got to a stage where I was like, you know what, fuck it. Like, if we're going to go in, let's go in for it. And you give me a code for that company that you used like a year ago, 2 years ago.
Skin and Me. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was like, fuck it, I'll just do that. Because I feel if I'm going to achieve a regular skincare routine, I need somebody just to turn up at my door and to be told, you do this in this order and we'll send you a refill when you need it.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like mm-hmm. to take all of the thinking out of it. So they did that. And yeah, so now I've got this kind of skincare routine, which is way more manageable than I thought. Includes like cleansing in the morning, serum, moisturizer, SPF. And in the evening, it's just cleansing. The specific like daily doser they give you, which is kind of more of like, which was actually the main selling point, because it was like, it's a more on the end of dermatology than it is just off the shelf skincare.
Active ingredients.
Yeah, like they make you fill out a questionnaire. They make you send pictures in. They make you, you know, tell them what you're looking to achieve, what you're looking to improve on and stuff. And then they cater something that they feel is for you. And then over time, they increase the kind of potency of it, I guess, because your skin's more used to it. So I was like, you're not going to get that from just going to Tesco and buying Nivea for Men. You know, like nothing I could really go out and buy that I'm comfortable with buying myself will ever be as good as this. Or as, theoretically. So I was like, right, if we're going to do it, we'll do that. And then after that, you just use a moisturizer and you go to bed. So that's very manageable so far for the last like 2 months, somewhere between 1 month and two. Every month is kind of merged at the minute. I've probably done it like 90% of the time, which for me is like astronomical, off the charts level of commitment.
Yeah,
to skincare.
Wow.
I'm only really missing like a day at a time maximum, maybe only like one morning every week, if that. And yeah, and I've not looked at myself and thought, my skin looks great. I'm only 1-2 months in. But I've looked at myself and not thought, oh, there's a blemish, or oh, there's a problem area that's flared up again. Like, I've not noticed that. I'm not saying that, but when I look back on it, I'm like, oh, it's actually kind of been a couple of months since I've said so, or since I've noticed something like that. My skin's been much more stable. It's been much more, like, I would get a lot of irritation on my neck from shaving. I would get some spots in certain places. Like, they would come back every month or like every 6 weeks in the same place. They wouldn't be big, they would be completely manageable, but I would just stick some tea tree oil on them and go about my day. Since I started this, I've just noticed like, oh, that's happening significantly less frequently.
Mm.
It actually really hasn't happened since I've started this. And it sounds obviously very, very obvious to say like, yes, I'm putting skincare on my skin regularly, multiple times a day, and all of a sudden my skin has gotten better. But for me, like, I've never been able to stick to anything. I've never been able to do anything consistently with this. And I'm not seeing anything like substantially amazing, but I'm not seeing the bad things as much.
Sure.
So,
and I think that's often what determines how you feel about your skin. You know, you're like, you kind of imagine sometimes when you get new skincare that you're like, well, will it make me glow? And sometimes it does, but like, generally speaking, yeah, sometimes I have to remind myself, I think, oh, I'm going to try and get a moisturizer I haven't had before, because like, you know, you want the thrill of the new. And then I think, why don't I just use the stuff which when I use it, I notice no problems whatsoever with my skin, which is really what you want. You're like, if you don't have redness, you don't have spots, your skin doesn't feel tight, you know, all that kind of stuff, then your skincare is doing the job it's meant to do. And
yeah, it's
you
like,
just want to stick to that.
It's not made me look spectacular, but it's stopped me from looking subpar.
Sure. Which is, you know, pretty good work if you can get it.
All you can hope for at 34.
All you can hope for at 34. Okay, well, I'm very happy to hear that, like, skincare, a couple of years after I bought you some skincare, it's finally it's finally sunk in.
It's a long game. And I got my first Skin and Me package for £3.50 because of your code. And I think you might have got some money as well.
Yeah, and I think you can actually, you can do that a lot with them. Like, I got like 3 months at that because you used it and Emma used it, and like,
yeah,
I just kept getting like months free. I've stopped using it now just because like I was kind of like, this is more expensive than what I was using before, and it was like, I didn't have any issues on it. I was just like, well, I didn't have any issues on the previous one, so I'm just going to kind of go back to that.
It isn't cheap. It's not so expensive that it's like unpalatable, but I think like things like their moisturizer and cleanser are more expensive than they need to be. but I can just source a nice light moisturizer and a good cleanser elsewhere for cheaper and just keep with their like active ingredient dosage thing.
And I think you needed kind of what Emma needed, which is like, I'm willing to pay a bit more so somebody comes up with the routine for me.
Exactly.
Whereas like I said, you know, I'm willing to do the research myself and I'm kind of like, oh, well, they had this active ingredient. I can go and get that elsewhere. Like for a lot of people, they just want to be like, here's like 40 quid and you give me all the three things I need. You give me a cleanser and my daily dose and a moisturizer and an SPF and I'm done.
Having to think and source is already too many steps for me.
Exactly. Exactly. So you're a skincare boy now. Finally. Yeah. Okay, mine's really quick. I just think it's good to have hobbies that you don't monetize. Mm. Have you noticed that now if you do anything for fun, everybody says to you, like, are you going to sell it? You know, or...
Like if somebody like crochets.
If somebody said to you, I do it as well. If somebody said to you, oh, you know, like I write in my free time, you might say like, oh, like, you know, what do you write? Are you making any effort to get it published? Like, you know, all this kind of stuff. And there's this idea that anything that you do, you should be looking to turn into a job. You know, if somebody paints, are they going to have an exhibition? Do they sell their paintings online? If somebody makes clothes for their kids, oh, you should sell these online. Like, people would buy these. Like, there's this whole thing across the board. And I think, like, it's good to have stuff that you do that's just fun. You know, and there isn't like it's great to do exercise. But quite often when you ask people what they do for hobbies, they literally just list exercise stuff.
Yeah.
And it does feel like exercise can be a hobby, but it often isn't.
Mm.
You know, if you just go to the gym, chances are it's not a hobby for you. Like you're probably not that serious about it. But yeah, I think it's okay to want to write, but maybe to think, I'm not sure I ever want anyone to see this writing and I have no interest really in trying to get published. It's okay to make ceramics and not think, oh, can I sell these? You know, like, should I go and do like a store? It's okay if you do want to do those things. If you say, oh, well, you know, like, I want to get better at it and one of the ways that I can tell I'm getting better at it is if I have an exhibition in a local cafe or, you know, I do sell some of my stuff at the farmer's market or whatever. If you want to do that stuff, that's completely fine with me. But generally speaking, I think we put too much pressure on people to use their free time productively to say like, oh, what are you doing with this? And it's actually fine not to.
There's a weird like subsection of hobbies that this in like this kind of are categorized with in that like if you say you play video games, you like playing video games in your spare time. It would kind of be weird if someone turned around and goes, oh, are you going to become a streamer?
Yeah.
Like it would sound really sarcastic.
You're going to be a professional League of Legends player. Like, no, like, I'm a normal person. You just wouldn't say
that because it doesn't translate. But as soon as it's specifically like anything you're making from scratch, so like knitting, crocheting, making clothes, whatever, it always seems like the angle would be to monetize it, which I think the problem with that as well is once you start monetizing something, it can quite easily become more of the job end and less of the hobby end.
Yes,
and you've lost the kind of one thing that drew you to that hobby in the first place, which was enjoyment.
Mm. So I like it when you find somebody who doesn't do that. When somebody's like, yeah, I like have a podcast that like makes absolutely fucking no money and I have no real interest in it doing so. Like, well, I do write, but I only do it for myself. I don't really care about like trying to make it, you know, as a writer. Like, yeah. I think all this stuff is really positive. And I think it's stuff that we should do more. I think more of us should just like take an interest in things and not try and turn it into a career because like our jobs take up enough of our fucking lives without being like obsessed by trying to make a little bit of income in another way, you know?
Was Heartstring always intended to be published at some point or was it just like, I'm going to see what Emma ended up with? Was that just writing for the sake of writing or was it like, I plan to try and pitch this out?
I think like Emma wanted to get published, I think.
Yeah.
But like at the same time, you know, she was writing it because she wanted to write it and because she enjoyed writing it. So like
this is Michael Body, not Heartstring.
Yeah, sure. But like there's a little bit of both there, you know. It's okay if there's a little bit of both. It's okay if you do want to turn it into a career. It's just that our instinct is always to ask people if it's going to be one, and it's just like just boring for everything to be work. It's boring. Like, I don't give a fuck. I don't care about people. I don't care about people's jobs, for one. I never, ever want to go to a party ever again and be asked, like, what I do and have to ask somebody what they do.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I know what you do.
painful small talk.
It's one of three or four jobs, none of which I respect.
Yeah. You're like, a consultant? Oh, you work in recruitment? Great. Yes.
I don't care. And it's also really fucking weird. Like now I'm a therapist as well. It's genuinely like strange how many people try and like neg you about it. Like where they're kind of like
being a therapist.
Yeah, like especially like kind of slightly conservative types. I think they're always kind of trying to be like, I think they feel a bit weird about it. Like they think they're being judged or assessed or something. And so they kind of start trying to imply that it's like, it's soft or like, oh, I don't think I'd ever go in for that kind of thing. Like trying to dig you out. And I think, well, I'm never going to have use for a management consultant, nor do I respect that. Like, I don't really care about the law because, like, I think that you could teach a pig to practice law. There's all this kind of stuff where I'm just like, well, I have these opinions too, but, like...
I'm also never going to wear a quarter zip and a suit to work, so who's the real loser here?
Exactly. So, I don't know, like, there's all this kind of stuff where, like, I start getting really punchy and then I think... Well, this all started because we had to have a conversation about our fucking jobs. Whereas if you told me what you're into and you're like, I'm really into like rock climbing and also I love drumming, but like my girlfriend hates it. So I had to get one of those electric drum kits and like play it in the loft, you know, like whatever. I'm kind of like, that's cool. That's much more interesting. That makes you a more interesting person than you being like, yeah, been handling like a big merger lately. Oh God, it's just a fucking nightmare. Like my boss all over me. It's like, I don't give a fuck about your boss. I don't care. I'm probably never going to think about you again. So let's just have a human interaction rather than like basically my LinkedIn talks to your LinkedIn. Like, fuck that. All right. I think that's a pod. Thank you very much to everybody for listening at home. Thank you to everybody who sent in questions. I put a call out for questions the other day and within like 2 hours, I had like 30 really good questions and we will get to a bunch of them in the coming weeks. Our new cover art is by Arthur Nascimento. You can find him at Totally Arthur on Instagram. And yeah, we'll catch a bunch of you over on the paid side. Thank you very much. See you later. Bye.